A reminder that Current State's second Pop-Up Stories event is coming up this weekend. Join us at the East Lansing Public Library Sunday afternoon. Our storytelling theme is Loaned and Borrowed, and the event will feature live music from violinist Rodney Page, 2 to 3:30 p.m. Sunday at the East Lansing Public Library. We ask all aspiring storytellers with something good to share with us to join us, okay? And we want to thank our partners in this effort, the MSU Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. Pop-Up Stories Sunday afternoon in East Lansing. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program today, Planned Parenthood, the nonprofit healthcare provider that delivers reproductive health care, sex education, and information to women, men, and young people worldwide, has been in the spotlight a lot lately. In July, an anti-abortion group filmed undercover videos that it says shows Planned Parenthood sells fetal tissue for profit. Planned Parenthood denies those allegations and says the videos were heavily edited. Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards appeared before the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform just last week in Washington. The hearing marked the first face-to-face encounter between Planned Parenthood and Republican critics since the videos. Those critics have helped make abortion and the drive to defund Planned Parenthood a top political issue. Here to talk with us today about it is Lori Carpentier, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Mid and South Michigan. Welcome, Lori.
Good morning, Mark.
Also joining us, Genevieve Marnin, Public Affairs Associate at Right to Life of Michigan. Right to Life is a nonprofit organization of people united to protect human life from fertilization to natural death. And Genevieve, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Genevieve, do the concerns that were expressed in the hearing on Tuesday over the videos, do those reflect your own concerns and the concerns of Right to Life to Michigan? Did we see a pretty accurate representation of Michigan's concerns?
The concern to defund Planned Parenthood is definitely one that we share in Michigan, yes.
But the discussion of the videos themselves.
Absolutely. Were those,
okay.
Absolutely.
Talk to us a little bit more about that. Briefly summarize.
Well, the videos clearly show, and there's a series of 10 that have been released so far. I understand there are two more that are waiting to come out, but they clearly show that there's a haggling over price for fetal tissue and organs, brokering baby body parts, as it were. As far as them being heavily edited, you know, these videos were all submitted to an independent forensics lab called Coal Fire Systems. And that independent forensics lab came out with the 14-page summary of it, saying that they were not heavily edited, and in fact, they were extremely accurate. In addition, the Center for Medical Progress released the entire footage, all 8, 10, 12 hours per video. So the edited part of the video that we saw that were 8 to 10 minutes was simply for time, but it certainly wasn't editing out the content.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sorry, but the fetal parts that you saw in the pie plate were not photoshopped.
Lori, let's give you a chance here to respond. Briefly summarize where you stand here in Michigan in the aftermath, especially of Cecile Richards' appearance last week.
Well, I think Cecile did us proud in letting the country know exactly what the truth is about Planned Parenthood and our commitment, first and foremost, to patients. And of course, no surprise, Genevieve and I differ on this. The videos were edited, and the so-called full footage isn't full either. So there are hunks that are missing. There are hunks that are overdubbed. We've had our own forensics done. And you know, but the point here is that that's all a backdrop when what Planned Parenthood is really about is trying to make sure that the 71,000 people in Michigan and 2.7 million people in the country get the basic health care services that they need.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a sprawling issue that we could spend the entire hour on. Before any more time elapses, I do want to talk about in a little bit more detail how this is playing out in Michigan. Because of the video, many states, including ours, have launched investigations of Planned Parenthood. Genevieve, I understand Right to Life sat down with the chairman of the Senate committee that will be investigating Planned Parenthood. What can you tell us about their plans?
Well, we were not consulted on this newly organized committee. It's the Senate Oversight Committee, and they were formed by under the direction of the Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhof to do investigations of Planned Parenthood. So it's a blank slate at this point. We did sit down with him, Senator McGregor, to discuss what avenues that he wants to take to do some investigation. Because, as you know, these videos show, if it's true, which we believe it is, this is felonious activity. You cannot sell baby parts. To go through and broker and traffic human parts is illegal in the country. So whether or not you want to call it a procurement fee, when you have abortion doctors haggling over a price, that's not a procurement fee. That's called reimbursement and profit.
Okay, so let's get back to the state investigation here and give Lori a chance to respond. How do you feel about the state legislature's investigation? What do you feel lay ahead here?
Well, first of all, we should mention that, in fact, the investigation committee is not specifically only to investigate Planned Parenthood. There are a number of things, and it's going to be a companion committee for the House committee. We also sat down with Senator McGregor and have full cooperation with them. We intend to show them whatever they want to know. Whatever people believe they have seen on the videos, what I can tell you is that there is no program for fetal tissue donation in the state of Michigan under Planned Parenthood right now, and has not been. So, you know, as we go forward this investigation, I'm going to be asked to prove a negative. It's not happening here. And when it did happen more than 20 years ago, there was no fee involved. So people can light their hair on fire if they like, but there's no there, and I'm fully prepared to show that.
We're talking about the Planned Parenthood debate, both nationally and here in Michigan. Our guests are President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Mid and South Michigan, Lori Carpentier, who you just heard. Also joining us, Genevieve Marnin, Public Affairs Associate at Right to Life of Michigan. There appears to be agreement that federal revenue cannot pay for abortions. But the fees, you've both alluded to this already, the fees that are permissible for the processing and transfer of fetal tissue are a source of real confusion and controversy here. Right now, nothing appears to govern how much tissue brokers are paid. Genevieve, short of banning abortion, would stricter regulation of fees be a step in the right direction?
Well, Mark, I don't think we need to ban abortions to ban fetal tissue research or procurement or fees for that procurement. So while it may be legal to take body parts from aborted babies and sell them, or let me rephrase that, get a procurement fee for them, you have to ask yourself in a civilized society whether or not we're okay with that. These videos very clearly show that they're altering the abortion procedure to get intact parts. And in fact, intact babies, whole fetuses, are being delivered in altered abortion practices in order to get intact brains. I mean, civilized people have to ask themselves whether that's okay with them.
What about stricter regulation of these fees that are a part of the landscape? Lori Carpentier?
Well, Genevieve just took the same liberalities that our friend Ms. Fiorina took on stage, none of what she said is accurate. And I think that people can, I think that when patients find themselves in this difficult situation and they make the determination to end a pregnancy, they are happy when they have the opportunity to donate fetal tissue. And the notion that this is inappropriate in the face of all the good work that the research results in is really short-sighted, in my opinion. It's not happening at Planned Parenthood in Michigan.
Some people have suggested that profiteering could be taking place among tissue brokers. Is that a concern for you?
Well, I think if it is, it certainly isn't happening at the Planned Parenthood end. And whether or not it's happening with the middle guy is not my purview. I can only speak to what's happening at Planned Parenthood, and nothing inappropriate is.
I'll come back to you, Lori. Explain for us how Planned Parenthood in Michigan is funded and how the money is used.
Well, this I'm happy to have the opportunity because this notion that somehow we inappropriately use federal funds is laughable from our perspective. Federal funds come to us in the form of really three things. One is the Federal Family Planning Grant, Title 10. The second one is Medicaid. In both of those cases, those are reimbursements for services rendered to patients that utilize those programs. And we have to show on an annual basis, more than once, how we use those monies. And last year, the total reimbursement that we got from Title 10 and Medicaid together fell short by about $1 million to cover the services that the patients in those programs required. So we raised that money to make sure that we could make the program whole.
One of the stories that I read yesterday, and I'm going to forget who used this phrase, but somebody from your organization, Planned Parenthood, used the word elegantly. It says that its abortion services are elegantly funded with public and private funds. Let me give Genevieve a chance here just to respond to the funding issue.
Abortion services are not funded by public money, Mark. I have to correct you on that.
You know, the bottom line is the monies are fungible. When the monies are coming into an organization that does do abortions, it may not be paying for the actual aspiration machine, but they're certainly paying for her salary, for the buildings, for the doctor's salaries. So maybe it's not directly paying for abortion, but when you have an abortion service going on in a clinic and they're getting Title 10 money, Title 5 money, Medicaid reimbursement dollars, yes, Medicaid doesn't pay for abortion services, but they certainly pay for all of the services leading up to the abortion and the services after the abortion. So I think we can parse out some numbers there, and we have to really ask ourselves whether or not our tax dollars are going to uphold a company that performs abortions. So my thinking is this: stop doing abortions and people won't have a problem with their taxpayer dollars going to support Planned Parenthood.
Now, Planned Parenthood exists in many places where other family planning clinics don't. They see, on average, almost 3,000 birth control patients per year, compared with an average of 750 seen at public health centers and 330 at federally qualified health centers. These are stats from the Guttmacher Institute. To put it another way, Genevieve, Planned Parenthood clinics comprise only 10% of publicly funded contraceptive clinics, but they see 36% of patients who use the government birth control programs. Some say that if Planned Parenthood were defunded, other clinics couldn't pick up that slack.
Well, thank goodness for Obamacare and the contraceptive mandate then, because every woman is required under law to have insurance, and every insurance policy must cover contraceptive coverage at 100%. Those patients can go to their family doctor, they can go to their local OBGYN. There are hundreds and hundreds of places where women can go in the state of Michigan to get their birth control covered at 100% with no copay.
Lori, what would it mean if Planned Parenthood in Michigan were defunded?
It would mean an increase in sexually transmitted infections. It would mean an increase in unintended pregnancy, and ultimately, in all likelihood, significantly more abortions. So I think, you know, the place where you would think that Right to Life and Planned Parenthood come together would be on prevention in the form of contraception, but they don't support that either. And if they had their way, abortion would simply be outlawed. I think the point is that while we would love it if the Affordable Care Act really meant that everyone got the insurance coverage they needed and that there were the appropriate providers available, that would be great. But a number of the patients that we see use Medicaid, and there are lots of private providers and others who simply don't take it because the reimbursement is so inappropriate.
30 seconds left. Genevieve?
30 seconds left. Right to Life of Michigan is not anti-contraceptive. Contrary to what she just said, we have no problem with that. We don't take a stand on contraception. So, again, I'm going to restate. If they quit killing unborn human beings, we would not have a problem funding Planned Parenthood.
We have been speaking with Genevieve Marnin, Public Affairs Associate at Right to Life of Michigan. Also, we want to thank Lori Carpentier, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Mid and South Michigan. Lori, Genevieve, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us,
Thank
Mark.
You.
current state on 90.5 WKAR. Visitors to the Bernard W. Baker, beg your pardon, Bird Sanctuary, a lot of bees there, in Bellevue, Michigan, no less, will be in for a treat this weekend. It's the time of year when thousands of sandhill cranes descend on the marshes there as they travel south. What makes the sight of these birds even more impressive is that 60 years ago, the state had only a few pairs of them left. Here to talk about the sandhill cranes conservation success story and the 21st annual Crane Fest is Executive Director of Michigan Audubon, Jonathan Lutz. Welcome to Current State, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
These days, Michigan hosts thousands of cranes as they make their way south for the winter. But as I mentioned, this wasn't always the case. How rare did sandhill cranes used to be in the state?
So at one point in the 1940s, we were down to fewer than 20 pairs of birds. So fewer than 40 individual birds returning to Michigan each year to breed and raise their young.
And this was from habitat loss or hunting or what? What were the causes?
Combination of both. The birds were unregulated and hunted. They were regarded as agricultural pests in some cases. But in many more cases, it was loss of habitat.
They are extraordinary birds. I don't know anybody, even amongst people who don't pay close attention to birds, and I'm kind of a bird guy.
Sure.
But the sight of a sandhill crane on the wing or in the field is really extraordinary.
Absolutely.
What brought them back?
So it's really a group of like-minded people, grassroots conservationists that include local Audubonners, but also working closely with state and federal agencies. So you have this combination, this partnership that is often required for non-game conservation in the state of Michigan and elsewhere, where you have enthusiasts, people who truly love the birds. These range from people in academia to agency employees themselves, hunters, fishermen, and of course, bird watchers, and working closely with our State Department of Natural Resources and the Fish and Wildlife Service, we were able to be successful in instilling regulations and protecting habitat where the birds can thrive.
Jonathan Lutz is the Executive Director of Michigan Audubon. We're talking about the Sandhill Crane and the upcoming Crane Fest in Bellevue, Michigan this weekend. Talk to us a little bit about the migratory journey of the sandhill. Where does it travel?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So in mild winters, we'll have sandhill cranes stay in Michigan all year long. That's not the norm. It's an exception, but it is something that we see in mild winters.
We're heading into an El Nino winter, apparently, so we could very well see sandhills through the winter this year.
We could. So the determining factor is the amount of snow cover we have. If there's significant snow cover, the birds can't find food, seed, and leftover corn, things that you would find out in the fields. So they'll move below the snow line. And a lot of our birds go as far as northern Florida and northward to Tennessee.
Tell us about Crane Fest. What do you have planned at this event?
Yeah, Crane Fest is a great two-day event. It's very family-friendly. It starts at noon each day, Saturday and Sunday, the 10th and the 11th. And people come. We have 25 artist vendors on hand. We have nonprofit exhibitors. There will be live animals from Olivet College, Binder Park Zoo, and I believe the Michigan Hawking Club as well. So people get some one-on-one time with a variety of species, and then people will bring armchairs and blankets and thermoses of hot cider and sit and wait for the birds to return to the marsh right around dusk.
And we will point out that the Baker Bird Sanctuary in Bellevue, a lot of people know where Bellevue is. It's between Lansing and Battle Creek. It's just a little bit northeast of Battle Creek. How many cranes will Michigan typically see passing through each fall?
So we do a census each year. I would not say that the census is 100% complete, but we see cranes now in the 20 to 30,000 range in terms of number of birds. Fall affords us this opportunity to count cranes because the birds, they change behavior. They're typically less friendly towards each other throughout the breeding season, but in the fall, they group together and stage for migration in these shallow wetlands like you find at the Baker Sanctuary. Mm. So at that site alone, towards the end of November and the early part, or excuse me, the end of October and early part of November, we'll see as many as 10,000 cranes just in that location.
Mm. Holy cow, that is a lot of birds. Do they cover the entire state? I mean, do cranes migrate as far north as the, you know, the Keweenaw Peninsula and the
sure.
UP?
Absolutely.
They do. They cover the whole state.
Yeah, so bird monitoring at Brockway Mountain on the Keweenaw Peninsula, at Whitefish Point in the eastern Upper Peninsula, both see significant numbers of cranes, some of which are going as far north as the the northern parts of Canada.
Mm. That far north, and how far south do they go? The ones who migrate fully, I mean, how far do they travel?
Yeah,
where do they go?
Sure, South Florida and the Texas coast, and we're speaking specifically of the eastern population of sandhill cranes, so east in the Mississippi River. There is a much larger and more significant population in the western states, and those birds will winter in Arizona, New Mexico, and in summer in Canada.
Same species, though. Same bird?
Yeah, there's a greater sandhill crane and a lesser sandhill crane, and we recognize these two populations as distinct.
Isn't there a similar collection or a similar assembly of sandhill cranes that takes really notable in, I want to say, Nebraska?
Yeah, that's the western population.
Yeah.
So you get
yeah.
birds passing through Nebraska and some staying there specifically as they do here in Michigan to breed and raise their young.
Well, Jonathan Lutz is the executive director of Michigan Audubon. We've been talking about Michigan's sandhill cranes and about this weekend's Crane Fest happening at the Bernard W. Baker Bird Sanctuary in Bellevue, Michigan. Jonathan, nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now it's time for another installment of Current State's Hear, Hear Project, and this one happens to tie in nicely with our discussion of the Sandhill Crane's fall migration. Current State's Kevin Lavery picked up the sounds of a pair of the birds last week near Bath. Oh, that's a great sound. Current State needs your ears to help make Hear, Hear happen. Submitting your own audio snapshot is easy. Use the Voice Memo app on your smartphone to record about a minute of sound. Once you're happy with your audio, you can email that file along with your name, a description of the sound, and the approximate location where you recorded it to currentstate@wkar.org. We're eager to hear your work. Coming up on Current State, Lansing journalist Mickey Hurton joins us to share some of his recent reporting, which includes stories on the upcoming Maker Week here in Lansing and on the capital city's healthy real estate market. Plus, Christine Thatcher was a fixture of the Lansing theater scene for many years. Tomorrow night, a special staging of one of her plays will be raising money to help her pay her medical bills as she fights ovarian cancer. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Christine Thatcher about the performance of her play, Waiting for Tina Meyer. That and more coming up after the break. This is a dollar short and a day late in a way here. I meant to thank some of the people who filled in for me here during a recent break. I was gone a couple of days last week and all of the week before, but I do want to acknowledge Melissa Benmark, Peter Worf, Michigan State's Sue Carter, and the MSU Alumni Association, Scott Westerman, for doing such a bang-up job of filling in for me here while I was in England, as it turns out. So many thanks to Melissa, Peter, Sue, and Scott. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State here on WKAR. Most of our listeners know our next guest is the associate publisher and columnist at the Lansing City Pulse and is the former executive editor of the Lansing State Journal. But Mickey Hurton is one busy and enterprising local journalist. He also contributes regularly to the Greater Lansing Business Monthly, and in the new issue, which is out now, he writes about this week's Makers Week events in Lansing. And he updates readers on the state of the capital city's real estate market, which he writes is in a pretty healthy state these days. Mickey, welcome back to Current State.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
You took some time to report on Lansing's real estate market, and you found we're in a generally good place, good for sellers and good for buyers. How so?
Well, it starts with confidence. And all of the surveys that people are feeling better about the state of the economy here. Jobs are up. And I did another story that we didn't talk about, but, you know, our unemployment rate is pretty low. It's about 5.1%. Yeah. So all in all, people are feeling good. And when they feel good, they buy. And Lansing, you know, the good side of Lansing's real estate market is the prices are unbelievably low, relatively speaking, and with good mortgage rates. So what we're seeing is, you know, the sales are up about 11% year over year. Prices are up.
That sounds huge. 11% sounds like quite
really
a leap.
Is. We've had quite a good year. In August, we did almost $80 million worth of real estate sales in this market. And that's pretty strong.
When you spoke with real estate professionals, what other benchmarks, what data benchmarks do they look at? I know median home price is one of them.
Well, they look at time on market. That's generally declined. They look at that. That's a pretty key one. They look at inventory, and they also find that the inventory is pretty slim. So in many ways now, it's becoming a seller's market. There was one, I sort of got onto this story on my own street. A house went for sale. I talked to the real estate agent there. He had 42 people show up at the open house.
It's the biggest
open house he's ever had. And so I talked to Bob Hubbell about this at a Coldwell Banker. He runs that firm. And he said, that was huge. And it's just reflective of the market in general, no matter which company you look at.
So you've got, in a way, you've got classic economics here. You've got stable jobs, people earning money. You've got higher demand and lower supply.
And
which means
low interest rates.
The median price goes up, and we are in a period of almost unbelievably low interest rates, which makes mortgages quite affordable.
And the thing I looked at in this article, and we put reporting in Greater Lansing Business Monthly, is that they expect this to continue. You know, real estate is cyclical. I mean, if you talk to real estate agents, it goes in like 4 or 5 year cycles. We should be, according to the real estate experts and those who know our market, we should still be in the up cycle. So they expect this to continue into the fourth quarter, through the third quarter, for the fourth quarter and into next year.
And I'm hearing that the Fed, if this has anything to do with it, the Federal Reserve is less likely now, because we've kind of hit a soft spot economically, the Fed is less likely to increase interest rates on the national level, which would probably have a little bit of upward pressure on mortgage
rates. But even when you think about that, but interest rates are still so traditionally low.
Oh, yeah.
And even if they were to rise 0.5%, let's say, which would be by Fed standards fairly high, that's unlikely to make a big difference in whether you're going to buy the house, maybe a couple of bucks more, $1,000. But it's still good. And the prices, I mean, you look at houses in Lansing and you know, nice houses are available in the Lansing market in the $100,000, $120,000, $130,000 range. And in some parts of the city, I mean, when you look at the reports, you know, in some parts of Lansing, I mean, houses are going for $60,000, $70,000. Mm-hmm. In some places, that's a year's worth of payments in some markets.
Mm-hmm. Mickey Hurton joins me. We're talking about some of his recent reporting for Greater Lansing Business Monthly, which involves the Lansing real estate market and the upcoming Maker Week. Business people can be reticent to talk about the negative aspects of how they're doing. Did you feel like you were getting the straight poop when you interviewed your sources?
Yeah, I
business
did.
Is always good, you know? I mean, I've heard that many times.
Yeah, trust but verify. You also look at the national statistics and what happens, you know, on markets like this, and whether it's unemployment or it's real estate or whatever. I mean, you check all of this against larger indicators, and you could sort through it. But, you know, business actually in this market is doing pretty well. Another story I had was on the beer market. I wrote about the beer industry, and that's booming in this community. So, you know, these are good times. And Chuck Ballard in his survey captured this. You know, when he did that state of the state survey, That's what we find. If people are feeling good, and they should, because there's an awful lot of good things happening in this market now. We report on them in the magazine, and we find some negative things, too.
Did any of the more anticipated commercial developments come up in your conversations?
No, I really didn't look at the commercial, but I looked at it last month, in the previous month, and there is a lot of commercial going.
Indeed.
And some of it happening rather quickly. I mean, if you look at... I think the fastest thing happening is that Aldi store out in Meridian Township has gone from nothing to a store that'll probably open in a few months. But you've got Whole Foods, you've got expansion of the auto industry, you've got the auto plants going throughout the community, and you've got big ones on the horizon. You know, you've got Jackson Nationals expanding, you've got there is that sense of confidence and opportunity, and I think that's the thing that happens here.
Another story in the new issue of Greater Lansing Business Monthly that you wrote involves the second Lansing Maker Week. Remind our listeners what Maker Week is about.
Well, you know, it's sort of tied back to what we're talking about. Lansing, in many ways, is a maker community, and it always has been. And absolutely the best example of that would be our auto industry. I mean, look at it this way. We're a small community, relatively speaking, with two monstrous auto plants making some of the most sophisticated cars in the world. Mm-hmm. And it reflects our Lansing tradition, you know, Ari Olds and the auto industry, and just the, you know, traditionally we've built things here. Well, Maker Week is sponsored sort of by LEAP as sort of the, you know, organization putting it together, but it's a celebration of how the community makes things. So it's everything from using 3D printers or book printing to food products to heavy duty manufacturing. We're at the West Lansing, the West Campus of Lansing Community College. It's a full week of events devoted to that. And some of it pretty interesting. There's one, it happens at the MSU library, that I'm particularly intrigued by, and it's book printing. You go in with your electronic file of your book, you put it into a machine, and out comes a printed volume of a book that's bound and cut and trimmed. You have facilities now and workshops where you go in and you can use 3D printers, rent 3D printer time, build 3D printer devices. And this is a celebration of that on that level.
It gets started today. We'll point out that it gets started at Impression 5, where there will be a panel discussion involving entrepreneurs who will discuss the maker culture and its place in the so-called new economy. But it continues at the MSU library tomorrow with the 3D printers and in the book printing that you alluded to.
And then it goes down. It goes downscale a bit, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but to the Allen Marketplace, where you have food processors, and which is a type of making, whether it's mm-hmm. jellies or it's, you know, bourbons or it's, you know, baked goods. I mean, all of this is making, and we sort of forget that we are makers in many ways. And so this is a national movement, and this is Lansing's, you know, tying into what is happening across the country. Mm. That's sort of interesting.
I like the way you got into the story by invoking Ransom E. Olds as kind of the original Lansing maker, which is appropriate, but you included something I'm not sure I ever knew, that besides cars, Mr. Olds worked on lawnmowers.
Yes, he did, and was one of the leading manufacturer of lawnmowers at the time. And when you think about it, before that, they were probably horse-drawn and pulled, and his motor technology gave him another avenue. And what better example of, you know, the ability to make and then seeing the opportunities. And that's really the entrepreneurial aspects of it and the kinds of things they'll be discussing today at the panel at Impression 5.
Mickey Hurton has been our guest. We've been talking about some of his recent reporting for Greater Lansing Business Monthly. Find them online. I believe it's lansingbusinessmonthly.com.
I believe so.
lansingbusinessmonthly.com. I'm pretty sure of that. And Mickey's recent reporting involves the Lansing real estate market and the upcoming Maker Week. Mickey, thank you.
Well, thanks so much.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Christine Thatcher is an actress and playwright who led Boar's Head Theater and later Stormfield Theater in Lansing. Since Stormfield closed in 2012, her ability to work has been limited by poor health. A group of her friends have worked to help pay the bills incurred while undergoing treatment for ovarian cancer. Their work continues on Tuesday night. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more. Tell us about this production of Waiting for Tina Meyer, Scott.
That's right. Sounds like a fun show. Christine Thatcher wrote this little comedic piece with a friend more than 30 years ago, Mark. In the days leading up to the staged reading at Lansing's Robin Theater, Christine Thatcher told me the story of how Waiting for Tina Meyer came to be.
Larry Hsu, my co-author, and I worked years ago together at Milwaukee Rep. And he was a wonderful actor, just an amazing actor, and we did Merton of the Movies together. And he also started trying his hand at writing and came up with plays like Grandma Duck is Dead and The Nerd and Wenceslas Square. And I was always in his first workshops. And I guess I was a little full of how he might improve his play because he eventually said to me, put your money where your mouth is. And he encouraged me to write. And that's how my first play started. It was all because of him. Well, his agent said, there's this series called One Day at a Time. Do you remember that?
Sure. Oh, sure.
And she said, why don't you submit a script for One Day at a Time? Well, Larry didn't have a television set. He didn't even know what she was talking about. So he invited me to trade the script back and forth. So we did, and we came up with this little, you know, script for One Day at a Time. We turned it into his agent, and a few days later, we heard the series was canceled. Yeah. But we liked this one woman that we had created, and so we threw away all of the One Day at a Time people and wrote a play around this one woman.
Kind of a spinoff.
And we had a reading of it in New York at the West Bank Cafe. It went very well. And then he was tragically killed in a plane crash. And I just took that script and tucked it in the bottom drawer, and that was it. And about a year ago, Greg Winkler, who is the artistic director up at Peninsula Players, where I go to direct and act once in a while, he said, you dig that thing out. I really want to see it.
And how do you even know about it?
I guess I told him about it. I must have told him about it. And so I did, and I'm really glad I did. It just brought Larry back in this flood of light. So I updated it and tried to hone it a little more. And they did a reading of it last April that went very well. And now we're going to do a reading of it here.
It's a one-act comedy. What's the story about?
The first stage direction is these two guys walk into a bar. Basically, they're both actors. They've just finished a performance, and one of them, Bob, gets a note backstage from what the stage manager says is a really beautiful girl, inviting him to go to this bar for a drink, and claims that he knows her parents, that she used to see him perform at Milwaukee, and he's so nervous that he showers and shaves before he comes out, and she's gone. So he grabs his buddy, Walter, and they head to the bar where she said she'd meet him. And that's where it starts.
All right.
They're waiting for Tina Meyer.
Christine, you've got some really great people working on this production. Let's start with John Leppard. Everybody knows from Williamston Theater.
Wonderful actor.
Great popular local actress, Laura Croft.
Yes.
Are they your leads then?
Everybody's sort of a lead.
Okay.
It's a five-character show, and they share stage time.
Andy Callis is in the show. He's from Lansing Community College.
Yes,
everybody around town knows Andy.
He's going to be wonderful, and he'll be playing the piano, and he's the bar piano player.
And a couple of Chicago actors, I assume friends of yours from your Chicago days, Michael Joseph Mitchell and Barbara Simpson Furman.
Well, Michael Joseph actually did Underneath the Lintel here.
When you staged that.
Yeah, at Boar's Head.
He did
a couple of things for me. Just a wonderful actor. Very, very funny guy. And Barbara Simpson Furman actually did the first play I ever wrote. This is called Niedecker, about poetess Lorene Niedecker. So she knows Larry.
Wow.
And and she's playing the mysterious woman.
Can I ask you about Larry Hsu?
Sure.
One more question about him. His death is so tragic. 39.
Yes.
This happened in 1985. This must have struck you very emotionally, I would expect, that you were close friends and to lose someone unexpectedly like that.
It was just horrible. And everybody at Milwaukee Rep grieved for days and days and days. We couldn't believe it. And, you know, when we talk to each other, we always wonder what he would have been doing now. He was so gifted, and he had just signed a deal with Disney to write, and he was doing Edwin Drood, I believe, on Broadway or off Broadway. It just was so tragic, and he was such a funny guy. You'd go to visit him, and there was always something cooking on the stove, but it was never food. It was like the nose he was going to wear in his next show. You know, he always did these strange makeup things that required, I guess, boiling, I don't know. But he was just the funniest, dearest person, and everybody who knew him just felt that loss.
I'm sure you've been thinking about him a lot in the last week or two.
Oh, yeah, yeah, how funny he was. Excellent tap dancer. You name it, he could do it.
We're talking with Lansing Theater mainstay Christine Thatcher. She's directing a one-time-only staged reading Tuesday night of her one-act comedy Waiting for Tina Meyer. We have to talk about the reason we're doing this show at all,
okay.
And that is your health.
Right.
It's well known that you have cancer.
Yes.
And are undergoing treatment. How are you feeling today?
I guess I'm a little anemic, so my energy isn't exactly what I would hope it would be. But basically, I'm doing okay. You know, it's my second round of chemo, and I've got two more to go, and I'm counting them down. I have this brand new granddaughter in Florida that I have to get down to see. So she's my main inspiration, you know. I also want to get back to work, you know.
Yeah.
So,
you know, I expect that a lot of our listeners will think this is not an uncommon problem in the theater world, that someone lacks sufficient insurance because of the life they've chosen in the theater. And as a result, you have a great group of friends who get together.
They are the
best. Let's put on a show and help pay the bills.
Yeah.
That's what it's been like for you, right?
Yeah, it has. And they are the, who knew these people would come together like they have and just devote all this time to making sure I'm okay.
Christine Thatcher is the former leader of Boar's Head Theater and Stormfield Theater in Lansing. On Tuesday night, you can see a one-time-only staged reading of the play she wrote with Larry Hsu. It's called Waiting for Tina Meyer. You can see that at the Robin Theater on South Washington Avenue in Lansing, starting at 7 p.m. on Tuesday. Christine Thatcher, great seeing you. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR, every weekday at noon as well on AM 870 and always at WKAR.org. MSU and U of M football both emerged victorious last Saturday, but headed in different directions in yesterday's polls, if you pay attention to the polls. With us now to discuss the latest developments is current sports, Al Martin of WKAR Radio and Television. How are you, sir?
How are you doing, Mark? Good to be with you.
I am well. Well, MSU fell from number 2 to number 4 in yesterday's polls. Significant? Should we be concerned here or what?
Well, I don't think right now, I don't think there should be any thoughts of panic crossing anyone's mind. But because it's so early, and I think in the sports world, and naturally so because of the forum that it is, a lot of people, when looking at their respective team from week to week and knowing how important the college football playoff is, I mean, in its second year of existence this season, it's easy to overreact when there are just some glaring needs for a team like Michigan State, and plugs that need to be, you know, really need to be filled right now as this team moves forward if they do want to be a part of those top four teams. Because, Mark, what we saw against Purdue on Saturday, when looking at how that game transpires, specifically in the second half, I mean, as a fan, yeah, I mean, you do have some legit concerns moving forward for this team.
And they are injury related, as I understand.
Yeah, well, there are injuries on this squad that are very hard to ignore. But you know how Coach D is. I mean, anytime us as media members now, even after the game, Mark, we know not to ask Coach D about injuries. Because,
no kidding.
I know, right? You know, it's like a taboo thing if you do, because you know he's going to just stare at you and say, "We don't talk about injuries
exactly.
on this team." He doesn't want to use that as an excuse. But I will say, though, Mark, I mean, the injuries for this squad have been so glaring and have been at key positions that it's hard to ignore. I mean, it started with Ed Davis going down. He's out for the season. Then you have to bring in a guy like Vyonte Copeland. Chris Frey is also doing, fill-in duty at the linebacker position as well. We saw a horrific, it was really hard to watch, Dennis Finley on Saturday as well. He went down and went to surgery that same day. Jack Conklin is gone for this team. R.J. Williamson had surgery on his right bicep. I mean, there have been so many injuries on this squad, but it's about depth. Michigan State's depth is being tested very early. And to be honest, Mark, you rather have that test early in the season so that guys who are going to fill in those voids get that experience and are accustomed as the season becomes late in the year.
Al Martin of Current Sports on WKAR Radio and Television is our guest. We're picking apart Saturday's Michigan State and U of M's game here in just a minute. Some Spartan fans are pointing to quarterback Connor Cook and saying he's not performing at a high enough level. Fair criticism or not?
I say no. And the reason I do say that, Mark, is because I don't think it's just Cook. And again, Michigan State is performing how they should perform early in games, Mark. I don't know what it is. It's hard for me to really put my finger on exactly why this team, when the third and fourth quarter hits, just seems to let off the gas and does not have that "I'm going to step on your throat" mentality. And that's what you got to have. If you want to be, again, one of the elite in the college football and have a chance at that playoff, you have to beat teams convincingly that you are highly favored against. And Michigan State, look, I have a few stats here, Mark, that were kind of glaring. And as I was flipping through today's Lansing State Journal, Michigan State right now is averaging 4.8 points in the third quarter, 10 points total in the second half this season. They are allowing, from a defensive standpoint, 6.2 points in the third quarter and 14 points total in the second half. So they are allowing more points than they're scoring in the second half, and that's why a team like Purdue was able to come back in that game. I don't know what it is. And for me, and the reason why I don't put it on Connor Cook, Mark, is because for me, from a play-calling perspective, Michigan State is way too conservative. At some point in that game, I expected to see Connor Cook sit in that pocket and challenge the secondary of Purdue and get guys like, you know, who has been his favorite target all year, Aaron Berbers, the football. That didn't happen. You saw a lot of running the football. You saw a lot of, you know, throws in the flat. It seems as though Connor Cook is playing with a leash on right now, so I can't totally blame that on him, Mark.
MSU travels out of state for the first time this season to face Rutgers on Saturday. What does that matchup look like, and how does Michigan State need to prepare?
Well, as far as what they need to look like, I think, they fell from, what, number two in the nation to number four in the latest poll. I think that Michigan State has to go into Rutgers territory and beat them at least by two touchdowns if they want to stay a top five team. Realistically, Mark, and this may ruffle a lot of feathers, and I'll go more in depth on this reason why later on Current Sports, I don't think Michigan State right now is even a top 10 team. I got to be honest with you. With the way they've looked in comparison to other teams in the nation, I just don't think they're top 10 right now. I think maybe 10 to 15, you know, around that area. But right now, number four, I just can't see it. But they need to go into Rutgers. They need to handle business and win by at least double digits. They got to cover a spread. They haven't done that. They're only one of five teams that hasn't done that this entire season.
I can only give you less than 30 seconds to comment about Miles Bridges coming to MSU men's basketball. Briefly, how excited should we be about this?
throw a party right now. We should throw a party right here in the studio. I mean, it's that big, Mark, because you get Miles Bridges, you get Josh Langford. I mean, Miles is a five-star. You get Josh Langford, Nick Ward, Cassius Winston. These are all four- and five-star guys. And it blows my mind. It really shows you where this program is going. Ty Mizzo is really, you know, making his mark in the world of recruiting right now. But this is huge. Maybe another top five. There's another guy out there floating as well that Michigan State may get a commitment from. This is big, though, Mark.
Current Sports on Radio. Hear more of the postmortem here on the Spartan-Purdue game at 1 p.m. on AM 870 from our guest Al Martin. Also, it's Current Sports on Television every Thursday evening at 10:30 p.m. Al, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Anytime.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, a Minnesota poet and artist has spent the last several months traveling the coastlines of all five Great Lakes. We'll talk to Moheb Solomon about his journey and the art that he created along the way. Plus, a new website from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services helps the elderly and their families connect with the agencies and services they need. We talked to Kerry Cederberg, Executive Director for the Aging and Adult Services Agency, about what the site offers and what kind of response they've gotten so far. That and more Tuesday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. Don't forget, Current State can go straight to your smartphone every day. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Have a great day.